Grade 2 Conference, Lecture 9, The Second Grader, Part 9. As promised, I'm going to say a little bit more about the Sanguines. I've spoken about the importance of appearances, that appearances are not merely superficial. A beautiful classroom, a well-dressed and a well-appointed teacher. These things for a sanguine really represent something very deep and very important. And of course, the sanguine is going to be generally sanguine children, the sanguine group, the most artistic, the most delighted at the flow of the Waldorf day with all of its variety. The melancholics like the security. The phlegmatics like the predictability, and the sanguines like the variety. And you realize, well, actually, Waldorf does have all those things. They seem contradictory, that you can only have one at a time. But actually, you know, we have predictability of variety and a variety of predictable things that go on. So the sanguines, it's as though the Waldorf curriculum was made for them as far as they're concerned. And all of the things that they're going to be learning, and they're going to be knitting and playing recorder, and I'm going to play flute. That's usually what the sanguines are certain of from the time they're born, I think. And I'm going to be in the orchestra and the class play. Can I have a big part this year? Last year I was just a tree. Could I say a lot of lines? You know, everything. But in that everything, sometimes not much is getting done or finished. And the sanguine is very, very aware of what everyone else in the class is doing, including all of her sanguine neighbors, but often her own book is two-thirds finished drawing here, almost all the words except for three on that page, and that drawing, oh, you were absent, you forgot to do it again. Be prepared. This is going to be a pattern for the sanguine children. The difficulty of finishing things and the difficulty of getting them to sit down and finally have to do it. It's a very difficult thing because the astral body resists complete incorporation. It also fights against finishing things. And you see this whole thing with all the children in the upper grades, and right now the sanguines are giving you a little preview of that. So sort of giving them tasks that are completable. As I would tell parents of sanguine children, you know, they would usually often complain to me, my daughter comes home and she's eaten half her sandwich. You know, she comes home and she admits that she gave away most of her food to the phlegmatic boy who sits next to her. You know, could you please, don't let her do that. Please make sure she finishes her meal. Well, you know, lunch is only 45 minutes long and she does need to go out a bit. I can't just chain her to her desk and have her finish. So what I suggest to the parents is take that sandwich and cut it into four pieces, or if you're really skilled, eight pieces. Make it into little sandwiches, and maybe you put different colored toothpicks in each one. Yeah, I know this is going to take hours, but if you want your child to be eating his lunch or her lunch, you're going to have to make it appealing. You know, put together little snacks, several little snacks instead of one big snack, and I can tell you it's incredible how this works. And it's the same with you as teachers. Try to find ways of dividing a drawing into different sequences, different aspects of it, with different colors and different moods. You know, they may not do the same drawing everybody else does. You may have to vary things a little bit. sanguines are often the exception to the rule. And then walk around the room and make sure you get to those sanguines. And if you see a sanguine hard at work with a color, you will say to the sanguine, stop drawing with that color. Work with this color now. But I'm not done. That's all right. You know, pick up that other color. I try to work with that. In other words, you show the sanguine you're more sanguine than they are. You tell them they're not working quickly enough. They're not getting that done. Go on to the next. Go ahead. So you have to play this little game in which on the one hand, you do want them to get everything done. That's important for their future. But for the present, it's also important that you make them get a little bit sick and tired of being so sanguine by telling them they have to be more sanguine than they are. And I know this sounds completely insane, but I can tell you I've done it with many, many children, and it is very powerful and very effective. And these are the children who, in the upper grades, when I walk up to look at their drawing that they're doing in a 7th or 8th grade main lesson book, you'll see these drawings if you take in a few years the upper grades online conferences, they would just say, "You can't, don't even look at it. I don't want your advice. I know what I'm doing." They didn't want me to be telling them anymore. Well, go faster. Work over there. Work on that part. And by then, I knew that they could be counted on to be focused, to be, you know, using their sanguinity to delight in being artistic, period, and not having to jump all over the place. When you tell them stories, when the stories are told, anything involving romance, laughter, something, you know, comical that happens purposely or inadvertently, and of course the beauty of the characters and what they're wearing and how many jewels they had in their crown and so on. Maybe when you tell a fable, you spend more time describing what the coat of the fox looked like, or you know, what the lion looked like. For the sanguines, how things look, how things appear is very, very important. As is, as I said before, talking about disciplining sanguines, love. You know, anything involving love and the attraction of one gender for the other, or I guess nowadays one gender for the same gender, whatever it is, the sanguine is going to be very, very interested in that. And that will be the part of the story that they will remember. Sanguines also can have incredible memories, and in fact, they actually can go on and become the most organized people in the class as long as the organization is for a good cause and is aesthetic. That is to say, you give them a notebook with 5 different colored tabs, or of course, they would just love any device that glows and gleams and sparkles and so on. But they will be the ones who will kind of organize a bake sale. They will organize a class fundraiser. They will play a big role organizing the class trip because it involves lots of different activities. Lots of different people work with them, along with them. And you will see how valuable the sanguine can be. Just don't ask them to organize the cleanup of the class or the leaf raking out there. They don't want to get too deeply enmeshed in the physical world. But things that are of social in nature, that's going to be a tremendous help in the transformation of the sanguine child. Now we'll look at our work with the choleric child. Of course, since you're only going to have a couple of them, we don't have to take a whole lot of time. But I will assure you that those 1 or 2 or maybe 3 truly choleric children that you have in the class will probably occupy as much of your time and consciousness, at least concerning classroom behavior, as maybe the entire rest of the class put together. Cholerics are really an incredible handful because they are bringing with them a sort of tail of a comet, or one might put it in another way. They're sort of bringing like cosmic fire down into the world, and that's hot to handle. And you really are dealing with a force. It's not just a temperament when you're talking about the choleric. You're dealing with the element of will, which is something that is very unconscious in our nature. You know, Steiner speaks about this. If we knew what it took to lift our arm, it would take us a whole lifetime to understand all of the processes just in our organism that go into that. And so we don't. We just let it all happen and sleep to it. It won't be until the very, very distant future that our ego will be able to penetrate our physical body and the other members of our body sufficiently that we will really be able to truly control our will. And then we will, in a way, be world creators. We will be cosmic beings in nature. The choleric already carries something of this. And this makes the choleric something of a stranger in a strange land, connected with everything else that we hold dear and in common. So this is one big challenge of the choleric, that they're bringing something which is of the nature of spirit, and generally Waldorf schools, and certainly we as Waldorf practitioners, are mostly about soul. We are not really working all that effectively on the level of spirit. It's Steiner who says we have to learn how to differentiate spirit and soul, that this is very important, that for many, many years, many centuries, the Catholic Church said that we could not take hold of spirit, that we are beings of soul only. And it's very hard for us to extricate ourselves from that habit of thought. And the choleric reminds us what spirit really is. When a choleric is working well, and very often in morning lesson, if you've got a compelling story and you follow that up with a stirring drawing or some really good writing, you will see that choleric take off and see the level of work of which he or she is capable, and the level of intensity and focus. You see how that fire can start to sort of burn its way through. In fact, they're the ones who have the beeswax crayons that pretty much melt in their hands, and you get this thick Van Gogh-like texture in their main lesson books because of that warmth that lives there around them. So when things go well with a choleric, it's terrific. When they don't go so well with a choleric, then all hell really breaks loose. They are the ones about whom parents will come to you, especially in second grade, and say, "My daughter does not feel safe with that boy in the class," or, "My son can't play with him anymore because he's so rough and so bullying," or, "If you don't get rid of that guy, my child is leaving." And remember, we have two other children in the school, and we're taking all three of them out unless that boy goes. Cholerics are the ones who elicit that kind of response from parents, and who bring sometimes fearfulness into the hearts of their classmates, and sometimes even more of a problem, lead other classmates on a path of seeming perdition at times, getting other kids into all kinds of trouble because the others just want to follow this beacon of spirit and will pretty much do whatever he does. Now, one way of understanding the choleric is a story that we will be hearing later on when I talk about the saints of all people. You'd think a fable would be a good way, but it's going to be the story of St. Christopher. We'll hear this later. And this story will, I think, say much more to you about this temperament than I can even fully share right now. But I'll just say a few things about working with cholerics, dealing with cholerics. And it's interesting because it sheds light on one of the big kind of conventional wisdom things in the Waldorf movement, you know, which is all classroom management. Here's advice on classroom management. Here's how to manage your class. And, you know, in the corporate world, a manager is fine. You know, it's not a bad position to have. Pays well, steady work, job security. But what you really are looking for in the corporate life, and in fact in life altogether, isn't just people who manage. It's people who lead. And you can do pretty well with classroom management techniques that you can learn in workshops and, you know, read about or whatever. I'm not going to share them with you in this conference. But that's not going to win over the choleric. In the same way that the sanguine is asking you to awaken in the way you dress, which you may not be the least bit interested in doing, the choleric is saying, don't just manage. You can't manage me. You've got to lead me. You've got to really be in charge of me. If you're just managing the class, I'm not interested. Sorry, I'm going to find ways around that. And, you know, it's just too bad for you. So if you cannot be an effective leader, at least vis-a-vis the choleric children in your class, they're going to leave, you're going to expel them, or you're going to, you know, just make things such that the family doesn't want to stay, or other parents will leave, or whatever. A choleric or two can be like a whirlwind, wreaking great havoc within the class. So how do you lead a choleric? Every day, you have to make visible to the choleric something that shows them you are stronger than he or she and that you are really capable of leading them in one way or another. So it means every day you have to find a way of telling the choleric to do something which the choleric will do. Something that you know is absolutely possible for the choleric to do. Something that you already picture inwardly the choleric doing it, and it can be as simple as every day that choleric waters a certain plant, or every day you know, you see a door open and you ask the choleric politely, not commandingly, to close that door, or please go to the secretary and give her this piece of paper or whatever. Some task that the choleric is accustomed on a one-to-one basis of listening to you. They're generally not that interested when you say, class, please sit down. Class, stand up now. The choleric won't always hear that. It won't always register with them unless you're making direct eye contact with them and you're telling them what to do. So you have to build up that one-on-one relationship and connection with the choleric, which is that you are his or her leader and he or she is following your work. In time, that relationship will become such that the choleric becomes, or the cholerics become, your right-hand man and woman in a certain way. Not because you tell them to be that, but just naturally, they become devoted to you, and they will, when they see other children not listening to you or the class rebelling in some way or another, they will speak, they will intervene on your behalf. And they are usually very popular children in the class, and their word will be heeded. They'll be followed. If they've survived long enough in the class, and if you've survived long enough in the class, for that kind of relationship to be built up. So this is very special. Your work with them is simply very different from your work with the other temperaments. It's got to be much more direct. They're not going to be impressed that you have a physical body. So do they, and probably by grade 6 or 7, they'll be at least as strong as you are and much more capable in a whole range of things. And my kids was even earlier than that. The etheric body means very little to them. The astral body, yeah, it's okay, but they are looking for people with egos. And you usually, the ego, the way a teacher in the primary grades brings the ego into the class, it's very veiled, it's very softened. It lives behind the etheric and the astral, and it doesn't have to show its face directly. But with the choleric, it does. This is where you have to, in a certain way, be most adult, most forceful, most secure in yourself, most confident, most able to visualize what's going to follow. If A is done, what will come in B? Cause and effect. These things that otherwise you're not really going to be bringing to the students for 3 or 4 more years, you're bringing that to the choleric in some small way or other on a daily basis, even in the primary grades. I'll talk more about the choleric and bring our discussion of the temperaments to a close in our next lecture.